This is an interview with Georg von Tiesenhausen by Michael Neufeld, January 22nd, 1990 in Huntsville, tape one, side two. Okay, so did you want to continue what you were saying, or had you finished?
Our independence was the only characteristic of our team that caused bad blood, so to speak, especially in NASA headquarters. And Werner von Braun used to go there and made his pitch and asked for the funds. But then he didn't want to be bothered anymore. He said, in 2 years from now, or whenever, 6 months, we deliver. And we did, always. And, of course, that's not the way it works, usually, mm-hmm. in this country. You know, who gives the money, he wants to have his hand in the pie. But otherwise, the team spirit has survived mm-hmm. at the Marshall Center. I think it is still there. The team here expanded, of course, mm-hmm. and people were drawn into it. Thousands of other people. At the peak, we were 7,500 people in Huntsville. And that was a team. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing.
So would you say that you didn't have a lot of problems integrating Americans organization?
No. There were perhaps problems here, there. But in general, no, not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Von Braun was very much admired by everybody working ever for him. And still today, of course, they talk about it. Mm-hmm. It was a very efficient integration of the team, very efficient.
Now, as far as of course, part of this whole story of you coming here and then the frictions that it might entail was the problem of the arsenal concept.
I remember.
And versus kind of, you know, which is, although it wasn't called that, in effect, Peenemünde was much the same thing, was the idea of having, I've heard the term alles unter einem Dach, you know, used by a couple of people. That is, you have everything under one roof, you have a big facility where much of the thing is concentrated in-house, not as much as contracted out. And then you came here, and the Army arsenal system was kind of similar, mm-hmm. so you could fit into that. But then you got into the NASA years, and there was conflict because NASA had more an Air Force style.
See, that's understandable. In Peenemünde, we were self-contained. Mm-hmm. We didn't need anybody else. We had the universities, of course. But that was it. We had to do everything ourselves. And like you said, in the first years here under the Army and with General Medeiros, we still maintained that we have to do everything ourselves. The first Saturn V booster, mm-hmm. we built it. And then gave the blueprints to Boeing. And said, now you do exactly as this shows. Mm-hmm. We developed the huge welding machines that welded these 33-foot diameter tanks. So we were used to do this mm-hmm. ourselves, and only reluctantly giving things to contract. And when we contracted things out, we had a bunch of people at the contractor looking over their shoulders, which they loved, you know, mm-hmm. can you imagine, you know, to find out if they do it exactly right. So we had our hands very strongly, even when we contracted out on the contractor. For a long time to make sure things were right. So that we brought, that was a heritage we brought, a legacy we brought along.
I just thought I would stop you for a minute because that's going to come through on the tape recording. It's going to be hard to understand. Okay.
So that was a characteristic of our way of working.
But you suddenly ran into a different style of relationship between the group and the contractor in NASA. Right? I mean, NASA had a system mostly adopted from the Air Force that you contracted for the construction of almost everything.
Yeah, right.
And that it was done in contractor plants, usually somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. You only supervised that as opposed to building it in-house.
We lost our in-house capability tremendously over the decades.
Mm-hmm.
When the anti-Osner forces became too strong. And on the other hand, there were areas where we maintained our capability.
Mm-hmm.
Aerodynamics. Systems engineering, design even in some area. What fell flat was manufacturing. Manufacturing mm-hmm. was out. I designed a lot of things here. I have 6 patents, and I'm a frustrated designer because in Peenemünde, there's a difference between American engineering education and German engineering education, a fundamental difference. In Germany, the emphasis is on design. In the United States, the emphasis is on analysis. So an American engineer analyzes the thing and then he designs. We design first. And then we analyze it. First, we put down how it's supposed to look.
Mm-hmm.
Then we analyze it and modify it. An American engineer does it the other way around, essentially. but both complemented each other very well. Only I disappointed a summer student very badly. I had summer students here. I gave him a big drawing board in his office. He says, what have I done? Do I have to draw? I wanted to give him a chance. So anyway, however, they complement each other quite well. The American engineers are very strong analytical in analysis. In Germany, we are better in design.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at some of the things you buy in a store, you may agree with that. How things are sometimes poorly designed.
Mm-hmm. Coming out of a couple of interviews, including Mr. Heimberg, he stated that he thought that a problem with American engineers was a lack of practical experience, that with that year of practical experience imposed by German engineering education.
See, I had 3 years practical experience before I went to engineering college.
Mm-hmm.
3 years. Dirty hands. Then, like one famous German author said, if you do that, you know how a piece of steel feels before it breaks.
Mm-hmm.
You get a feeling for the material and for shapes. And I never want to miss my practical experience that I had. That's the difference. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You think that's a superior aspect of German engineering education?
See, that way, you guarantee that what you design can be put together. There are some automobiles, when you want to change spark plugs, you had to take off a wheel to get to them. That's impossible design. You know, just as an example. Those engineers had never done it themselves. So we were very good in design. Of course, we were pretty good in other areas, too. The American colleagues were very good in analytical engineering. Very good. Interestingly, when we came here, many parts of the rocket had no English names. Mm-hmm. Only German names. So in some of the laboratories, German was spoken, essentially, because we didn't, there were, the other names hadn't been invented yet. Like for cutoff, when the rocket engine cuts off, Brennschluss, and others. So in the guidance area, so we transferred a lot of German words into it, and later they were substituted, of course.
Okay, let me now go back to 1943.
Yeah.
And some of the specifics. So I think we sort of talked about the first couple months.
Mm-hmm.
You got there and you were assigned to the testing and
launch area.
Launching section, which was still under Thiel at the time that you started, right?
Yeah.
At least he was
on
top of it.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was killed only a few months later in the bombing raid. Did you know Thiel at all at that time?
Yeah, I'd met him a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was your impression of him as a personality?
Well, he was a typical German scientist. A little bit aloof. Very knowledgeable. Extremely knowledgeable. And capable. And but personally, when you met the person, he was a little bit distant. If I recall it right.
Very correct, professorial.
Yes, yeah. He was not the famous German picture book professor. He wants to boil an egg and hangs his watch in the water, looks at the egg. You know, not that type, no, but very distinguished, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
My main contacts were Heimberg and Tessmann.
Mm-hmm.
And Fowe.
What was the name? Fogel?
Theo Fowe. V-O-W-E.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in German, the V is pronounced like an F, and the W like a V.
Right.
Fowe. And he died a year ago. They introduced me into the secrets of test and design rockets. I picked up very fast. Was very enthusiastic. And caught on very quickly and had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my element, really.
Mm-hmm. So you were close to, in fact, not just in some area distant from the design and so forth, but actually seeing tests daily.
Yeah.
Engine tests, launches
right.
Close by.
Yeah, I was thoroughly familiar with all the plumbing, you know, involved.
Mm-hmm.
With the fuels, with the oxidizers, with the Meilerwagen,
big carriage. Which is the transporter. Yeah.
The transporter, yeah.
For the A4.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The next job. Well, one of the first job was improving on the test stand 7. Then test stand 2,
mm-hmm.
I did all myself, the design.
Mm-hmm. That was the Wasserfall
test? Wasserfall engine test stand.
Uh-huh. Was that... Now, I remember Mr. Heimburg describing his design of a Wasserfall test stand. Was this a different test stand than 2?
That was the one which was together with the A4 test stand.
Mm-hmm.
You know that picture I had here was 2.
That was 9, was it?
9, yeah.
That was
a more advanced one.
Was that for launching as well as testing?
No,
or just,
no,
just
no,
for just static testing
static
of whole
testing, yeah.
Whole missiles?
Whole missile, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And from that, I took the design then of the floating test stand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the floating test stand had to have everything the other had. I then started a series of blast tests into water. See, the floating test stand exhausts into the water, into the water of
this
the Baltic Sea.
This is now when, 1944, though, right?
That was early 44 here.
Mm-hmm.
Had to blast into the Baltic Sea. And underwater, I had a deflector to get it back up. And nobody had ever done that. What happens? So I had a whole test series designed to do that. It was a small engine in a water tank. And it worked out fine, and so we could build the floating test stand. And the floating test stand had to have everything the other test stands had on land. The only concession made was in the first tests of the floating test stand, when we had the first C2 in it, we controlled it from land, not on the ship, because we were very close. Later, that was changed.
Okay, let me just stick to 43 first.
Yeah.
You were assigned to test stands, and you were there till August, and then the air raid came up, and you were living in the settlement at the time?
At that time I had moved out of the barracks and lived in Karlshagen, which was nearby, the village nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Had a room rented. And when the air raid came, we were in a hole in the ground with an iron plate on top. And we thought the last day of the world had come.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands of tons of bombs. And that's very well described right here in this
in the Middlebrook book. Yeah.
We survived, and we saw all the damage. I sent my wife home.
To Hamburg?
To Hamburg, yeah.
Which was also
involved. At that time, our people in Hamburg had moved to another place, Rothenburg, toward Bremen.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of it?
Rothenburg.
Oh, Rothenburg.
Not the famous one.
Also with TH or with
no,
T?
No, without an H.
Rothenburg.
Yeah, near Bremen.
Mm-hmm.
And so she went there to her mother. And then I was transferred with other colleagues to the Hungarian border.
Mm-hmm.
And to start building test stands there. That lasted about 6 months or so.
So you would have been there until early into 44?
Yeah, and then we were called back to Peenemünde and lived still in Karlshagen.
Okay, in Austria, you were evacuated to Austria. How many people from the test stands were evacuated, and the people around you?
About 40, I would say, between 30 and 40.
And was an evacuation specifically linked to Wasserfall? Was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the
group I was with was specific Wasserfall. I don't know if. Mm-hmm. The V2 was further ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Wasserfall was still lagging.
Did you get the impression at the time that they had wanted to evacuate the whole Wasserfall testing and everything
there was
to Austria?
A company, there was a company created. It was called Rax Works. Mm-hmm. Raxwerke. R-A-X.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe you heard about
it. I've heard of it because already they had originally been intended to be one of the V2 or A4 manufacturing sites.
Yeah.
I think it's also, even before that time, was a government created or transformed aircraft corporation.
Mm-hmm. So under their wings, so to speak, we worked there. And designed the test stands, but they were never built.
Mm-hmm.
Preparations were made there, but I don't know exactly how far they got. In the meantime, we were called back then.
How far? So at the when you were there, so you were somewhere near Wiener Neustadt.
Yeah. You? Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you were right in the vicinity of Wiener Neustadt.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And so while you were there. Sort of under the, were you working at the Rockswerke? Were your offices there at Rockswerke or somewhere just in the neighborhood?
Yeah, right. Yeah, we were there at the offices.
At the and you designed, you laid out designs for test stands.
Designs for test stands.
But that was it. They didn't get off paper.
They poured the foundations, and I still remember how scared I was. I was scared to death because I had designed everything from memory. Mm-hmm. I was scared stiff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Once concrete is cut, it's cast, there's nothing you can do, you know. No, it was never built then. Mm-hmm. And then we moved back.
So you probably weren't privy to this information, but did you get the impression that Wasserfall, that they had intended to evacuate Wasserfall by and large from the Peenemünde area and then change their mind about it? Or
that's the first thing I heard. No.
Mm-hmm.
Not to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Not
that
to
they
my
had
knowledge.
Just intended to manufacture engines or components of Wasserfall at Rockswerke or. Or test them there, or what was the intent behind this?
C2 was started later than A4.
Yeah.
And it had a completely different propellants, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It had a completely different guidance mechanism. It could be steered with a joystick from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It had at that time not flown yet. Only statically tested. So that it would be located at the separate development place. I never heard about that. That, to my knowledge, everything on the C2 was at Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm. Because it gives the impression when you say that they've developed this facility and so forth, you know, I'm trying to figure out, not having enough knowledge of it, whether the intent was to move the Wasserfall development away, or whether they just were going to develop a manufacturing facility for the test stand. The test stands are intended to do what? You know, that was the question.
I never heard of the Rockswerke later again after I left. Never.
Mm-hmm.
Development of the C2 continued. One of my projects was a field filling station for the C2, where you can fill it up. You know, it was transported, of course, without fuel, and preparations were made to put it out in the field. At that time, I didn't work anymore on C2 then, when 44. Yeah, in 44 I had the floating test stand. But as time went on, I was put back on the V2 with the submarine launch, which was a tremendous job. And I designed then the test stand for the deflector,
with
the U shape. By the way, that's how the submarines are launched today, you know, from the ground. Underground, you see the two jets coming out.
Yeah.
Same principle.
Now, I guess out of submarines, they use a cold launch.
Yeah, right.
But that's what they originally had to do, was to have that do those deflectors like your...
Right. So, and with the submarine launch, that worked pretty well, because those exhaust tunnels were on the outside, surrounded by water on three sides, water cooled.
Now, as far as the Wasserfall is concerned, when you got there, and in the months after you got there, how far along was the engine development, specifically sort of finishing the design of that Wiesel-Zalbai?
Yeah, the engine was continuously tested.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the Prüfstand 2 came in, the engine test stand, where dozens and dozens of engines with different mixture ratios and were tested, and different controls and so on. It was under very intensive development.
And that was in 43, or are you talking about 44 when you came back?
Let me see. Late 43, early 44.
That's when you got back, you saw this going on. When you got there, when you were there from, April to August.
Yeah.
There were not yet tests on a Wasserfall engine?
Not to my
knowledge,
no. Then I built that Prüfstand 2.
And that was finished, or you just put the design down and then it was...
While you were away. While I was doing the drawings, they already started casting the concrete. That was hair-raising. And I told you the idea with the viewing port. So I had to lay out first the concrete and then put all the plumbing and then provide for holes in the wall, for the tubes to go in and out, and pipes and all that. It was a very great rush job. It worked out fine. The first test was perfect. And so there were two test engineers. Rudi Reichel was one, and an Oberleutnant Schäufern, S-C-H-E-U-F-E-L-N. And it worked perfectly. So engine testing was number one on the C2. Then the main problem, tank emptying the tank, lasted several weeks, the development. And then flight tests. I did not attend any flight tests. I cannot give you any exact information when they started. But it must have been late second half of 44, somewhere there.
I think the very first one was early in 44.
It could be, yeah.
But now I had the impression that that there were delays in developing Wasserfall that were caused by either shortage of materials, the war situation.
Well, that was a continuous problem we had. Shortness of material, including the fuel production. For instance, to have enough alcohol for the A4, we had confiscated the major portion of the German potato harvest. And food was already at the premium in Germany. You know, we used the potatoes to make alcohol. So all these supply problems and shortages, and then superimposed on that political problems, pressure from various political organizations, speeding up, hurry up, and it was a very, very complex operation. And so complex that I don't think one person was able to look through all the aspects of what was going on all the time, because after all, we had our job to do. Mm-hmm. It was in front of us, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extremely complex, the whole situation. Very explosive and changing political pressures,
mm-hmm.
increasing and decreasing. And, at one time, we were supposed to be closed and become a tank factory,
mm-hmm.
or airplane factory. So,
Who do you mean? Who was going to be closed?
Peenemünde was supposed to be stopping all work on rockets in 44. And
well, there was a plan to evacuate to Austria with a facility called Zement, which was an underground facility.
Yeah, that I'm not familiar with. Mm-hmm. But airplane, fighter planes, or tanks
mm-hmm.
were the alternative for Peenemünde
mm-hmm.
at some time in that period.
Now, did you get the impression that Wasserfall was held up at all by political infighting between Army and Air Force, or between groups
no.
inside the Air Force, or from what you could see?
But
were there delays or problems?
But what I remember
by that?
Is that Wasserfall is a prime example of cooperation
mm-hmm.
between Army and Air Force,
mm-hmm.
because each one contributed. Like, I was nominally assigned to the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
And we had Army people all over us, too. And in the level of management, I was not aware of any infighting
mm-hmm.
between the two factions. I think the major problems in the development came from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
We were under tremendous outside pressures, political, economically, supply-wise. Materials got shortage of materials, fuel, oxidizer. Of course, we had our own oxygen plant. I remember I was involved in another oxygen plant design, but not for Peenemünde, for some industry. Maybe it was for Austria, oxygen plant, but I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm. But can you remember any specific information about outside political intervention or that might...
Not on C2.
Mm-hmm.
Not on C2. Yeah. I regret you. Not on C2. There was much more political interference with the A4.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, when production was... When they got into production, then there was a massive investment needed in planning and organizing
yeah.
and getting resources and manufacturing.
Besides,
we weren't
ready.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't ready. And it went into production.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to train troops. I mentioned the Mylar wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And attached to it was a launcher
mm-hmm.
at the end of it. I worked part on the launcher, too. So my work consisted of a lot of bits and pieces in between bigger projects,
mm-hmm.
like Prüfstand 2. And in many cases, it was like a fire brigade. Suddenly mm-hmm. had to concentrate on some aspects. But overall, and I talked enough about the team spirit, in spite of all the strain and pressure, we were a pretty healthy bunch then, and thought that we knew that what we were doing.
Yeah. Now, as far as the politics are concerned, did you note a significant amount of Nazi Party intervention or?
Yeah, it was interesting.
Your microphone just fell.
I'll be with you in a minute. There is a reluctance sometimes that we don't know what is being made of all the information.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Sure.
And some people don't like to be interviewed at all for various reasons. That's why you have not yet any, say, biography of anybody from Peenemünde, from the team here. There are some books with Dornberger,
This is a number of von Brombach books, but none of them are very good.
That's right.
None of them are good at all, as a matter of fact.
I have one by himself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in German, is it? I can show it you in a minute. Yeah, how about tomorrow morning then?
Okay, if that's fine by you, if you don't mind, my coming over.
Yeah, from 10 to 12 or so?
Yeah, I'm supposed to meet the historians at the UAH who are going at 12 o'clock, but it could... But I could also ask them to postpone it to, say, 12:30.
See that you catch Don Tarter,
mm-hmm.
At UAH.